And then her... Today's guest, Marilyn Pittman, grew up in a funny family, and then her dad shot and killed her mom, and then he shot and killed himself. He was a World War II vet. Her mom was a poet. Marilyn Pittman says it could happen to you. I survived it, mostly, and I'm a comic. She tells her story in the critically acclaimed solo show It's All the Rage, which is running now in San Francisco. On today's Your Call, Marilyn Pittman joins us to talk about dealing with tragedy and loss. What will it take for society to have an honest conversation about these issues? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The Afghan parliament has passed a strongly worded resolution about the killing of 16 civilians by a US soldier. It said people had lost their patience with the actions of foreign troops. The victims were shot in their homes in Kandahar province before dawn on Sunday. From Kabul, here's Quentin Somerville.
The Afghan parliament condemned the killings and demanded that the soldier be tried in an Afghan court. But the military agreement between the US and Afghanistan means a soldier will be tried by the US military. Sources close to President Karzai say the murders will complicate negotiations on a strategic agreement between the two countries that could keep US troops in Afghanistan beyond 2014. The identity of the gunman still hasn't been revealed, although some reports say he's a 30-year-old man with children of his own.
The US Defense Department says the soldier had completed several tours of duty in Iraq, but had not been posted in Afghanistan before. Opposition activists in Syria have accused the government of carrying out a massacre of women and children in the city of Homs. Video footage that cannot be verified appears to show some bodies with their throats cut. The pictures include young children covered with blood. Syrian state television blamed the killings on what it called armed terrorist gangs. At the United Nations in New York, the British Foreign Secretary William Hague told a meeting of foreign ministers that it was time to show leadership and unity over finding a solution to the Syrian crisis. He said the Security Council had failed and should find a consensus on Syria. From the UN, Barbara Plett.
Continuing disagreements were apparent in statements by foreign ministers attending the meeting. Russia's Sergei Lavrov declared the Syrian regime was battling armed groups and Islamist extremists. America's Hillary Clinton retorted there was no comparison between a government's brutal military machine and civilians driven to self-defense. But both of them noted recent points of agreement between Russia and the Arab League, which could perhaps serve as a basis for the Security Council to finally speak with one voice on Syria.
The European Union has insisted it'll press ahead with plans to charge foreign airlines for the carbon emissions they produce during European flights. China, the United States and others have objected, as has the airline industry. Chris Morris has this report from Brussels.
Letters sent to European leaders by senior figures in the aviation industry warn that intolerable pressure is being created by the new EU law. The CEO of the aircraft manufacturer Airbus said China had suspended orders worth billions of pounds, putting at least 2,000 jobs at risk. The industry leaders urge politicians to find a compromise before it's too late. The European Commission says it would welcome a global deal on ways to pay for carbon emissions caused by aircraft, and it's consulting industry bodies.
Chris Morris reporting from Brussels. World News from the BBC. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Iran, Ahmed Shahid, has criticised what he calls a striking pattern of human rights violations in the country. Mr. Shahid called for an investigation into post-election violence in Iran in 2009. He also asked Iran to consider a moratorium on the death penalty and to ensure that peaceful assembly and freedom of expression are not criminalised. Tehran has refused Mr. Shahid a visa. The head of Brazil's Football Federation, Ricardo Teixeira, has stepped down from his post. He also handed in his resignation from the 2014 World Cup organising committee. Mr. Teixeira, who led the Brazilian Football Confederation for 23 years, had been under pressure to resign over corruption allegations, which he's denied. He's been investigated on suspicion of crimes, including tax evasion and money laundering, but has never been convicted of any offence. The controversial art historian Maurizio Seracini says he's found evidence that may lead to the uncovering of a lost masterpiece by Leonardo da Vinci. He believes samples from a hidden wall in the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence contain traces of paint that was only used by the Renaissance master. From Rome, here's Alan Johnston.
The existing wall in Florence's town hall is covered by a fine Renaissance fresco, but the art historian Maurizio Seracini believes that behind it lies something truly magnificent, Leonardo da Vinci's lost fresco called the Battle of Anghiari. Mr. Seracini was recently allowed to drill tiny holes in the wall, and now he says his probes show that something is painted on a panel behind it. But Mr. Seracini's project is bitterly opposed by dozens of art historians. They've cast doubt on the theory that the Da Vinci lies behind the wall, and they've objected vigorously to the way the search has been conducted.
BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On May 17, 1997, Marilyn Pittman's father, a World War II veteran, bought a gun and fatally shot his wife of 49 years. He then shot and killed himself. As you can imagine, the tragedy turned her family's life upside down. After her parents died, she pored through her mother's journals and her father's post-World War II love letters, trying to figure out if they really loved each other. Why did they stay married if they were so unhappy? She eventually came to understand how their love eroded over time into dangerous patterns of hate and fear. Marilyn Pittman tells these stories in her critically acclaimed one-woman show, It's All the Rage. It took her 13 years to find the courage to work on this show. All the Rage won the Best Woman Show Award at the 2011 United Solo Festival, the world's largest solo performance festival in New York City, and it's running at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco through April 15th. And the show really focuses on the relationship between her mom and dad, how that affected her, how she coped with the murders, and then really the larger questions. What will it take for society to really have honest conversations about everything from PTSD, rage, murder, and madness? Marilyn Pittman is one of San Francisco's first openly gay comics. She emerged from the comedy scene during the AIDS era of the late 80s and early 90s, and she's co-host of Out in the Bay, a weekly half-hour radio show on KALW, which airs Thursdays at 7. And Marilyn joins me here in studio. Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Rose.
I saw your show on Thursday night, and it was so incredible. And what I loved about it is within 1 minute, I was laughing along with the rest of the crowd. You didn't hit us in the face, but the feeling was so subtle. You kind of, I was speechless, and I looked at my friend, and he looked at me, and we just sort of went, wow. So you laugh and you cry, and I mean, it's just so effective.
It's 28 scenes in 60 minutes, and so it's a roller coaster.
Yeah.
I feel so strongly that, you know, as a comic, I'm always, always, always like, oh, you know, like, they didn't laugh at that. Why didn't they laugh at that? I always want that laugh, because that's really kind of my greatest joy, is to make people laugh. If you can do that, if you have that talent, that's just something you crave. And so I'm always looking in the show to take care of the audience. And I think that this show, it's a tough sell. People see the title and they see the topic and they're like, oh, why do I want to go see that? Well, because it's a story of survival. It's not just the story of murder-suicide of my parents. It's the story of how you cope with loss, how you cope with trauma, mm-hmm. how you survive these horrendous things. And this can be anything from a car accident where you lose someone suddenly, or a heart attack where you lose someone suddenly. I mean, sudden loss is its own Megillah, you know, it's its own difficult realm of to cope with. So it's that, and then it's also through the eyes of a comic. And the other part of it, I want people to laugh because my stories are funny. Like, what I've gone through to survive this, mm-hmm. the people that I've lost besides my parents, the adventures I've been on, the craziness I went through, the madness of my own rage, my road rage. I start with road rage. So right. That's why I start with the laugh. So I want to let people know I'm okay. It's going to be okay. I'm going to take care of you.
How, when you performed, I was just thinking, how does she do this every night? Because I watched what happened after the performance, and I noticed that you come out and you engage with the audience.
A little bit, yeah.
And people share their own stories with
yes.
you. So you actually have to also turn into sort of a therapist in a way.
Well, I've done a lot of therapy,
yeah.
and I'm not a therapist, but I feel like I'm a conduit for people to be able to express that. I feel like that's my job, to be able to let people, you know, mirror their own experience with me, because I can handle it. Because at this point, I'm an authority in the space. It's almost 15 years, and I'm doing a show about it. And I just feel like I need to be available if people want to do that. To some extent, you know, I do have to protect myself. I can't just open myself completely. After all, I just spent an hour on stage completely bearing my soul.
Right.
So I kind of gave you what, you know, what I have to give. So I don't have that much more after the show. But I do a little bit of that.
And what is it like to do this? So you're performing it Thursday, Saturday, and Sundays.
Yeah. So it's three nights a week.
Right.
I just opened it this last Thursday, and it runs through the 15th. So it's five different weekends. And so I don't know what it's going to be like. All I know is that I'm glad it's Monday, and I'm glad I have 3 days off, four really days off before I have to get back into performance mode, because launching a show is always difficult. You know, all the effort that goes into build the audience and get the review and do it all and do the tech and all those things that go into it. But the show is so familiar to me because I did it in November in New York and also in San Francisco in November. And so, you know, it just comes back pretty easily with a few hours of rehearsal.
So after this happened, after your father fatally shot your mother and then shot and killed himself, it took you about 10 years to find the courage, but then you say three more years to really find the courage to work on it.
Yeah, I started working on it with David Ford at the Marsh in 2007. I took a winter workshop and workshopped it and developed 20 minutes. And that 20 minutes is still part of the 60 minutes that is existing today. And I walked away from it. I just couldn't deal. I just wasn't ready. And I was ambivalent about the solo show form in terms of I really, really, really didn't want to do a solo show that wasn't art, that wasn't true art. I didn't want to do something that was just cathartic for me and it helped me heal and I'm processing my problems on stage, because I find that to be really tired. I have some disdain for that aspect of solo performance. I think it has to go to a more universal theme. It has to reach people on a larger level for it to be considered worthy of my devotion and attention and all the hard work that it takes. And also just the emotional work that it took to sort of open the box. And I think in 2007, I wasn't ready to open the box.
Mm.
And then in 2009, The Marsh commissioned me, along with five other artists, for the New Performance Initiative. And we workshop things, brought pieces in every week for 9 months. So then you've got this long incubation period where you're just kind of bringing in material and trying it out and seeing what pops and seeing what doesn't and seeing what part of it is therapy and what part of it is maybe art. And that process of sifting through it like that and really stretching out with it was absolutely the key to making a successful show. Well, and plus, David Ford is brilliant.
What was the emotional process like for you?
Difficult. I almost walked away from the project three times. Mm. I have a letter I wrote that I never sent to the Marsh saying, I can't do this. I got to bow out. This is not working for me. And I just, it was the dark winter of early 2010. And it was opening the Pandora's box. I had compartmentalized this. This is what you do with trauma. If you want to survive it, you have to have some denial or some compartmentalization. You know, you push it away. And I had done this for so many years that I became just so prickly and so unable to cope with any kind of thinking about it. I just pushed it away and pushed it away. And it was taking a toll on my health, my mental health and my marriage and my physical health. And it became time to change. In 2007, actually, I was at a breaking point. And so then it changed, and I developed the 20 minutes. And then I walked away because it was just, I wasn't sure of the piece artistically, and I wasn't ready. I think readiness is everything. Readiness for love, readiness to deal with problems. You have to be ready. And so then, in 2009, 2 years later, The Marsh commissioned me, and I decided I'm going to open the box. And it was tenuous. There were moments of, you know, I just didn't want to read my mother's journals, and I didn't want to look at that, and I didn't want to go through. You have to go through it, you know, and it's a gauntlet of emotion.
I think the other thing that spoke to so many people in the audience is when you shared the story about the relationship between your mother and father, and so many people can relate to this. So talk a little bit about that. Your father was a World War II vet. Your mom was a poet.
Right. My father was a war hero, a sergeant on the ground in Germany, in the army. I bring a Nazi sword on stage from his, you know, from his war experience that he had. My father, I think, suffered from PTSD. My father, though, you're dealing with a generation, the greatest generation, which, of course, I raise doubts about. I don't know that it is the greatest generation. I think that it is the most damaged generation in some ways because of the war, because of that war. But at least with that war, you came back, unlike Vietnam, and you were a hero. Mm. And you really were a hero. You saved the world. So here's this guy who saves the world, who didn't get what he needed as a child, who was an only child, whose parents neglected him, who found this beautiful woman and courted her and married her, but she was on the rebound from this guy she really loved. But it was at a time, so here she is, they're both in college, they're in Denver, and he's on the GI Bill, and she's the head of the school paper at her college, and Colorado Women's College it was, and there's a lot of pressure on this generation to get married, on these women. It's a feminist story. She doesn't have the choice. You know, think about the jobs you could have when the men came back from the war and took the jobs back. Secretary, nurse, flight attendant, teacher. That was it. The boomers are the first generation. I'm a boomer to you know, with the feminist movement to break the revolution in the 60s to be able to work and do whatever we want. I mean, it's been an uphill battle, but still a lot more freedom than my mother had. So that's partly what the story is about. But back to their marriage. So my father was madly in love with her, just madly in love with her, just swept off, just crazy about her. And I think she was, from the beginning, loved the attention and somewhat ambivalent. And after 2 years, she knew she was unhappy. But then the first child was born. In those days, you didn't have divorce. Divorce wasn't really popular until the 60s or 70s, really, till the 70s. Late 60s, maybe, with the revolution, I suppose. The sexual revolution changed everything, but the feminist revolution as well. And so my mother was trapped and unable to really make a good living for herself and encouraged by the society to do those roles of wife and mother. And my father became a very controlling, you know, my way or the highway. I'll give you something to cry about. World War II vet who was a hero who basically it was a man's world. The men, you know, were in charge.
Let's hear a clip. This is Marilyn Pittman talking about her father and her mother's journal. This is a clip from her solo show, It's All the Rage.
It's an Indian chief sitting high on his horse on a mesa. It's an old print. I don't know where my dad got it, but I grabbed it during the madness that week. That and the 100-year-old Navajo rug. He was going to sell that to get a penile implant. Hey, this is before Viagra, people. All this Western stuff is what I love about him. It's hard to find something to love about him. My parents were married 49 years. 47 of them unhappy, at least my mother was. 2 years in and she knew. Well, why did she stay? Well, there's something compelling about being desired. But she would write about it in her journals. For all those years, questioning her choices. Why can't I have a deep relationship? What am I resisting? I can stay here doing the same thing, or I can move, or he can. But it seems expedient to keep living together. I can give in, start the old routine of sex, or I cannot. I played the game for 30 years. I don't want to do it again. But if I do, she was a Pisces. But if I do, it could make things easier. Why can't it be loving? Her way out was metaphysical, not physical. She began to withdraw or ascend, depending on your point of view, into the world of the spirit, the other side. I have no physical body. I am spirit. Stop holding on to anything material, physical, let go. The only lasting phrase I've heard is, I am all in all.
And that is a clip from Marilyn Pittman's one-woman show, It's All the Rage, running at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco on April 15th, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sunday. And you can find details at yourcallradio.org. What goes through your mind when you hear yourself talk about your experience?
Oh, well, you know, as an actor, which is what my training is in, actually, you know, I'm listening to that, and that was recorded, I think, in 2010, and I'm doing it now, and I think my performance is better. So, of course, I'm, like, critical of the performance. I think you're, you know, and I think it's also fun to listen to it because I miss my mother, and I love my mother, and she had her faults. She stayed too long, and she was ambivalent, and she was passive and sort of a victim, and she had her problems, but she was so charming and so beautiful. And I took a picture of me backstage before I went on and put it on Facebook. And I look like my mother. I look at that picture and I'm like, oh my God, I look like her. And every night before I go out there, I just, when if I have nerves, I always have nerves. And I'm always, you know, it's always difficult. It's always difficult to go out there. Not because of the content, even just doing a show for an hour right. with people looking at you. And so there's a sense that what always helps me is I just look in the mirror and I say, I'm doing this for you, Mom. Here mm-hmm. I go to tell your story. And so listening to it and listening to her words is, as always, it just touches my heart. It's sweet. It's a sweetness.
And it's such an intimate setting with the stage. You've got people in front of you and on your right and your left.
Mm-hmm. Very intimate upstairs at the Marsh, yeah, in Valencia. Uh-huh.
You know, the other thing that struck me is when you talked about your conversations with your mom about why she stays with your dad.
Yeah.
And you could, I have so many friends who've had that conversation with their mom.
Why are you letting him treat you like this,
right.
treat us like this? What? This was in 1996, this scene between my mother and I, late at night in Virginia, actually. She's there in D.C. I'm performing, and she happened to be there visiting a friend, so she came to see the stand-up, which was fun. And then we went and spent the night together at her friend's in Virginia, and I confronted her because I'd been doing, oh gosh, 10 years of therapy. And I figured out I'm having trouble sustaining relationships, and I didn't have a good model. And so those are some of the lines that I say to her. And this is what I said. This is a fairly accurate conversation. In fact, I try to be because I work in journalism. I'm a voice coach to NPR. I travel the country, et cetera. And so I try to, you know, work very honestly as I can to capture the reality that I experienced. And so it was intense to confront her. And I'm really glad I did because she died a year later. Mm-hmm. And at the time she died, I really feel like I had nothing left unturned. I had really cleared the energy with her. I really felt like we were communicating and we were in sync and we'd really kind of worked through our stuff. To ask her, you know, why are you staying? And she just couldn't do it until she could. And then she didn't know how to move out and stay away from him. And people warned her. Everybody warned her. Don't go over there. And she kept going over there to make him lunch. And she actually got into a thing where she lied to him because she was going to do a voiceover. Actually, I come from, you know, it's all DNA, right? Talent, I think, pretty much. And suffering, I don't know. And she lied to him. And this is what caught him in a jealous rage. Mm-hmm. He was convinced she was having an affair. And then he caught her in a lie. And he flipped.
We're speaking with Marilyn Pittman about her one-woman show, It's All the Rage, running now at the Marsh Theater through April 15th. And we'd love to hear from you. I'm sure this speaks to so many people. How do you deal with family tragedy, family issues? How do you cope? How have you survived? What resources are available for you? And then we'll talk about this in a couple of minutes, but the larger questions about what it will take for our society to really have an honest and deep conversation about things like PTSD, about rage, about murder. But what's happened in Afghanistan? The American soldier murdering 16 Afghans, that is directly related to this. So what will it take for society to really tackle these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Do you have a parent or a relative who's a veteran who's had to deal with these issues? And what's that experience been like for you? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment because I've been pushing this concept around since the early 70s, 71, 72. So it's been over 40 years. And that is circumstance where the more primitive the cultures in our history, the more allowance there is for grieving and separation and the loss of a family. It usually would always gravitate somewhere between a year to 6 months, usually more closer to a year, in which the individual was allowed absolute freedom to go through their grieving process and receive absolute support from within the community, not so strictly the family. That shrunk to the size of the family, with the institution of more codified laws that were established, and then it disappeared almost completely with the advent of the Industrial Revolution and labor-intensive industrial societies. So I always found that interesting, that the more primitive cultures, theoretically, would be much more allowing for the healing process of loss.
Can I ask you a question? Are you saying or do you feel that we are that we don't have a good, healthy process for grieving in this culture? Is that sort of your take on it?
Yes, that's exactly, because if really if you look at today's modern culture, the majority of people, individuals we come in contact when we lose a brother, father, son, sister, daughter, wife, it can usually a lot of times it will range to sympathy will start going very thin around the 2 weeks.
That's exactly, you know, you're so
to get over it. I've lost, we've all lost. I had an uncle who lost, now get back to work. That's a far cry from what, as I said, the more primitive culture saw as understood as 6 months to a year with absolute support.
I love what you're saying. I think you're absolutely right on that. We don't have a good process. We don't have a cultural understanding of grief. We don't have cultural allowance of grief. And I can't tell you how many people I would say, oh, I'm, you know, like 3 months later, I'm like, oh, I'm just having a really hard day. Why? Well, because of my parents. Oh, you're still dealing with that? Even my wife, who got together with me about a year after it happened, she thought it would just kind of, you know, ease up. And it lasted my PTSD. I mean, basically, I still have some symptoms of PTSD. I get triggered a lot less easy, and I manage the triggeredness a lot better. And so you can get well from this, but it takes a lot of work. And I think people are just like, oh, don't, you know, because I think people are afraid of the darkness. They don't want to. Everybody's trying to, and you can understand this. People are going throughout their day. They don't want to be brought down about death. They don't want to be brought down about the reality of dysfunctional, dangerous marriages and people on the brink. I mean, you see it everywhere in the society. People are on the edge. People are not just on the edge. They're going over the cliff and taking others with them. And we don't want to think about that. We don't want to think it could happen to us. And I think that's one of the messages of my show is, hey, these are normal people. This can happen.
Mm-hmm. What are your symptoms?
Oh, when I say the word triggered, you know, you get triggered. I have some anxiety sometimes, but you can get triggered. Like for the first 5 years, you know, I got triggered by, say, in the show, I got triggered by so many things. The cadaver scenes on Six Feet Under. I still can't watch women being murdered on TV violence shows. I think that's a good way to name them, TV violence shows. I can't watch women being brutalized or murdered in any way, shape, or form. I can't watch it. It isn't even a choice, actually. Well, I make the choice, but I can't watch that. That can trigger me. And when it triggers me now, it just like it doesn't last very long. But I used to get triggered any kind of conflict with my wife or friends. I get triggered for like a week or 4 days or 5 days. I would just be like in this kind of state of upsetness for a few years, the first five or even all the way up to like, I mean, really, it's just been a difficult path to recover from this and to identify what it is I'm feeling and to understand it's coming from, you know, I wasn't always like this. This happened to me when I was in my 40s. And so, you know, I had a whole life where I didn't have these symptoms. So I know that, okay, these are these symptoms. And so anxiety, some of the rage, some of the anger that I have, like that manifests in road rage. I say in the show, I'm in recovery. You know, I go to meetings where they hand out these special gloves where they curl around the steering wheel so you can't flip anybody off. Which is, you know, I'm making that up as a joke, but it works.
And what about that larger question about why we don't have a grieving process really in this country, or really even talk about these issues in depth?
I think we have a youth culture. I think we orient our American way of life is all about the 18 to 35 demographic in terms of advertising, I think, and then 18 to 49, anything, you know, but over 50, you know, it's kind of old, don't remind us. And I think we don't want to be reminded of our aging and our dying. I mean, look what we do to try not to age and die. I think that's part of it, but I think that we don't have tools. I think that people don't have tools. I think there's a sort of, you know, up with people mentality in America where you're just supposed to buck up and have a good day. And I think bucking up can be very good. I think sometimes you do have to buck up. And, you know, I'm a staunch Midwestern kind of person. I agree with that. But at the same time, it's denial to not at least understand what's causing you to act in certain ways.
We have to take a quick break. We'd love to hear from you on this issue. How do you cope with tragedy and loss, and what will it take for our society to really have an honest conversation about everything from PTSD to rage and murder? 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
Back to your call in just a moment. High school students all around the Bay Area pursuing careers in finance, information technology, and biotech are looking for summer internship opportunities. If you'd like to make a real contribution to the future of these students, you can find out how to get involved in the summer internship program at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our agenda for our new economy show. We'll be talking about changing the corporate tax system. From 2008 to 2011, 30 major corporations paid no taxes, according to Citizens for Tax Justice. So what's the economic impact of this, and what changes would you like to see? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Marilyn Pittman. She's one of San Francisco's first openly gay comics. She emerged from the comedy scene during the AIDS era of the late 80s and early 90s. She co-hosts Out in the Bay, a weekly half-hour radio show on KALW, which airs Thursdays at 7. And she's currently performing her critically acclaimed one-woman show, It's All the Rage. It focuses on many, many issues. Her father, a World War II veteran, bought a gun and fatally shot his wife of 49 years back in 1997. He then shot and killed himself. So it is about that, but it's about so much more than that. It's about survival. It's about coping with loss. It's about tragedy. And the larger questions, at least the question I really took away from it when I saw it on Thursday, is why aren't we talking about these issues? Because at the basic level, we all deal with this, whether it's our mom and dad fighting, why didn't mom leave our dad? But the larger issue is we've got so much tragedy happening in the U.S. Look at what's going on in Syria, in Gaza, in Afghanistan. Just in the last 2 days, we're seeing so much murder and tragedy. So what will it take for us to really have an in-depth conversation about these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And on an individual level, if you're dealing with anything that's related to this, please call in. Marilyn is so incredible. She'd love to talk with you about these issues.
Well, you know, I track this murder-suicide thing.
Yeah.
In nationally, but more in the Bay Area. There's one in Alameda. There's one in Fairfield. There's almost one a week. There's at least two a month. It just seems to me. And one of the reasons the show is called It's All the Rage is because my parents killed, you know, this murder-suicide happened to my parents in 1997. So that's almost 15 years ago. Back then, you didn't hear about murder-suicides very often. And, you know, we come from the Midwest, and so we're pioneers. And so maybe my parents started a trend. I know that's a dark joke, but I feel like there's something about what happened that it's just been on the increase over this last decade. People are losing it. We see it. I mean, we see the lady at the faculty meeting. We see the guy in the Safeway at Tucson. We see all this madness around us, all these shootings at schools. I mean, it started with Columbine, yeah. Right around that time in the late 90s. And then just the other day, there's a thing in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania. There's just one story almost a day of this kind of random insanity and then very targeted insanity.
And I'm afraid that we've become so used to it, where the last school shooting, it got headlines. I didn't really hear many people talking about it.
Like, people don't talk about this. I mean, I think the show, in some ways, it's been a tough sell. I've got the review in the Chronicle, and the man is, you know, clapping in the chair. And you know, so people have been given permission to come see this show. I think that's what that does. Mm-hmm. But I think people say, oh, murder-suicide, the funniest show about murder-suicide you'll ever see, which is the tagline. They're like, oh, I don't want to go see that. I think since 9/11, we're living in an age of anxiety. And I think people also are kind of burrowing in, and they don't want to look at the darkness because there is so much of it. And I don't blame people. Right. I get that.
But I think that we're not addressing it in any kind of dialogue, like you're saying in the show here.
When you're looking at murder-suicide, we have a listener who emailed who said, do you ever see instances of women killing their husbands and then killing themselves?
Well, unfortunately, they probably don't kill themselves. I said that. Well, they should. I mean, really. Well, really, go ahead and take yourself out if you're going to be that heinous. The woman who killed that fantastic actor who was in the Pee Wee Herman show, who was so fantastic, Phil Hartman, his wife killed him. Mm. And then the girlfriend of the former NFL player from the Titans. I'll think of it in a second. I can't think of his name right off the top of my head.
Andre Rison?
No. McNair. Steve McNair was murdered by his girlfriend, a jealous girlfriend. Mm. A lot of jealousy in it. A lot of times that's what the jealousy is. And then they're sometimes just old and they're, I don't know. And then the woman who killed her autistic son and herself the other day down the peninsula here.
I didn't hear about that one.
I don't know if he was autistic, actually. I think I don't want people to get all crazy because that's different than, but he was mentally disabled in some way and she had to take care of him. And she just was like, I've had it. Mm. I can't take this anymore.
Let's hear from Melanie in San Francisco. Hi, Melanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, you've already touched on what I was talking about, or what I had mentioned, which is the guns. And I just don't see the society really talking about the 500-pound gorilla in the room. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're a big part of all this, and I don't understand why they don't bring up the fact that
I love this.
They're not only used violently, but as a last-minute sort of explosion. Someone just goes nuts, picks up a gun, which they normally wouldn't do, goes because it's available.
Right. Okay, so let me speak to that. So this is absolutely, you're right on target here, Melanie. Absolutely. Here's the thing I thought after this happened to my parents. This is in Durango, Colorado. And I thought, and of course, Colorado's easy to get a gun. It's a very macho kind of place. And so here's what I thought. What about this? What about having your name on the newspaper website or in the newspaper? I mean, newspapers are sort of dead. But what about having your name published as somebody who wants to get a gun for 3 weeks before you're allowed to get that gun? And if anybody protests it, you don't get the gun. My father never had a gun. Mm. He went and bought this gun in April of 1997, and by May 17th, they were dead. And so it was premeditated, and he was able to just go and get a gun from one of the guys down at the store, you know. Damn Walmart, probably. And what if you want the gun and you have to wait 3 weeks and everybody can see who wants a gun today? And the family's like, uh-oh, Dad's trying to get a gun. No. And then no. Then you're going to have to strangle her. You're going to have to bludgeon her, which could happen. But guns make it really easy. You fly into a rage, you pull the trigger, really easy. So I'm extremely anti-gun. Mm. And I feel like there is not a dialogue about guns in this country.
It seems like it's gotten worse, actually, over the past 5-10 years.
It's terrible. And you can go get a gun if you haven't committed a crime, but what if you're about to?
Right. Well, also, people don't realize how easy it is to get a gun. I was at a gun show in Oklahoma City looking at semi-automatics and said, as someone who lives in California, how long would it take me to buy this? 3 days.
Whoa. Yeah, then, yeah, wow. So there you have that.
Yeah.
That's a huge aspect of this story.
Well, thank you for calling in, Melanie, and thanks for raising that important question. Let's hear from Danny in Santa Cruz. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the show.
This is Jamie.
Oh, hi. Sorry about that. Hi, Jamie.
No problem at all. I couldn't agree more about the guns. A dear friend of mine lost his daughter to suicide a couple of weeks ago, and whatever the dynamics were of what was going on, the truth was that the husband had 6 loaded guns in the house. And if he had not had 6 loaded guns in the house, she probably would have followed a pattern that many females do if she's that depressed, which is to take pills but let somebody know. And she would have survived. So,
wow.
So I don't know what would have happened. Of course, something else might have happened, but we know what did happen. The other reason I called was that relative to how to deal with post-traumatic stress, I just wanted to stress as a therapist that even though it is absolutely true that most people don't want to help their friends because if their friends are down, because we're just not we need to learn how to be more supportive of each other. So somebody's down, of course we know why they're down. So what? Why can't we lift them up? If you ask a granddaughter and tell her that her grandmother said, she won't run away from the grandmother, she'll help the grandmother. So anyway, that's an important thing. The second thing is that there is available very good treatment by psychotherapists to handle or at least lessen the impact of post-traumatic stress. What is sad, these techniques include in vivo exposure and something called EMDR, but whatever the techniques are, I'm saying they're relatively successful in lessening the anxiety, lessening, making the person feel more alive again, all kinds of things for childhood sexual abuse and all kinds of other problems down to a car accident. What I'm saying, though, is that people don't seem to know that, and veterans simply suffer. I had a dear friend who suffered for 50 years from his memories of the bulge. He didn't ask for any help. So the real problem I see is that people don't ask for help. That is sad.
I think you're living in a culture, too, where I think men have grown a lot and have had to grow, and I think men are learning how to express themselves. I mean, I'm a huge sports person, and I see the more emotional energy and more tenderness between men in sports now. And I think that, you know, my father's generation, you just suck it up. And you just don't ever share any of that. You have to be the man, and you have to provide, and you have to get a job, and you have to show up every day and be there for your family. It's different now. The roles are changing. Things are a little more balanced. But I think, you know, and certainly for his time, you know, to sit around and cry, you don't cry about it, right?
And also,
he could have cried. It would have helped.
When you look at the culture in the military, it is slowly changing to try to get help
for
PTSD, but way too slow.
Well, and I say in the show, there's a line I say, PTSD, that's what my father had after the war. They didn't treat it back then. They barely treat it now. I wonder what happens over time when it's left untreated. We're dealing with 49 years of marriage, and I think he had it the whole time. I mean, I think my dad was definitely suffering. I don't think he wanted to talk about it, and he didn't, and he wouldn't talk about it. But I think that it was part of his makeup after that.
I hope this sparks a conversation about what we're going to deal with when hundreds of thousands of soldiers come home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, they've been coming back and killing their wives
and
themselves, as I say in the show.
And here's the thing. The New York Times did a really good piece about this, and it just sort of fizzled out. It didn't really gain much
traction.
That's
the news cycle. It's only interesting for 48 hours, right?
But how do we have this conversation? Because do you think that society realizes what we're in for here?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I don't think the society cares. I think everybody's just kind of burrowing in and trying to focus on their few people and their little world. And I think there are good reasons for that. I don't have a lot of judgment about it. You can't, you know, make people deal with the darkness if they don't want to, especially since people are trying to have a decent life and trying to continue. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't wake up every day and feel like the whole world is just bleak and have any kind of spirit to give to other people.
So what would you like? So, for example, when we're looking at what happened with the soldier killing 16 Afghans, what do you want this conversation to sound like? Where do we begin here?
Compassion. I think compassion for what it's like to be a soldier in a war and the kinds of stresses I think we have since we've had a volunteer army. We cannot find out enough about the potentially mentally ill problems of some of these men and women who join. I don't think we have as much of a way to vet because it's volunteer and we've needed people to come forward and we've taken everybody almost. And because of that, I think that some people with mental health problems enter the military, and those are the ones we're seeing, whether it's Abu Ghraib or all of the different atrocities. I mean, go back to Vietnam, My Lai. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about individuals who are bringing their history. Maybe they've been abused, whatever it is. Or maybe they're just traumatized from war itself, and this prompts them to go on a rage killing spree like this guy did.
We're speaking with Marilyn Pittman about her one-woman show, It's All the Rage, running now at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. It runs through April 15th on Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. It focuses on her childhood, her relationship, the relationship between her mom and dad. Her dad was a World War II vet who bought a gun and fatally shot his wife of 49 years. He then shot and killed himself. How are you dealing with tragedy and loss? If you're dealing with something, right now? Where are you turning? What resources are available for you? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And when we talk about the larger questions about how we can have conversations about this, so many of us are so desensitized. What sort of different approaches should we take? How would you like this conversation to start? What would you like to really focus on? 866-798-8255. And if you're in a family of veterans, if your parents were veterans, or if you've got siblings who are veterans, maybe you, how are you dealing with these issues? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Charles in Albany. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm a veteran of Vietnam, and I do agree that it's important to control guns, but you know, there are plenty other ways to kill people and hurt people, knives and so on. So that's really not a solution. I would plead for more focus on, especially in domestic situations, for the dynamic between a husband and wife, a husband and family, and so on. Because the pressures that a returning veteran comes home to, he may not be ready for. There's added pressures, added complications.
It's true.
The dynamic between the partners in the marriage, I think, you know, it takes two to tango, so to speak. In some ways, you have to focus on the actual dynamic between two people, because that when you come down to it, that's really the situation.
You're so right, Charles. You're so right. That's exactly right. My parents' dynamic wasn't, it doesn't know my dad's fault. Of course it is, because he committed an act of murder. But it is a dynamic that they got into, that he was unhappy in the marriage and he couldn't leave. And she was unhappy in the marriage and she couldn't leave. And so the fact that this is their failure. They failed to get out of it. They broke up in 79 and then they came back together against the advice of his inner voice. And so they failed themselves, each other, their family, and their society. And so I do think you're absolutely right on that.
All right. Thank you for calling, Charles. Let's hear from Virginia in Berkeley. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. Thank you for this great conversation. Things that are coming to my mind, I know people that are involved in the Occupy movement. Well, there are a lot of things coming to my mind, but trying to distill it down. It seems that the word compassion was used, mm-hmm. and I think of the word honesty, mm-hmm. and I think of dialogue in different activist groups. Dialogue, waging peace, instead of, there's a whole mentality of militaristic, even if it isn't so-called violent, it's this kind of strategic military thinking rather than a real focus on what it takes to wage peace. And I think part of that, other besides compassion and honesty, starts with trying really hard not to blame other people. So I just want to throw that out. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have an email from Danielle who says Marilyn would really appreciate Diane Keaton's new book about her mother and herself.
Oh.
Some similar issues of generational differences and mm-hmm. women's issues. It's called Then Again. Her mother also kept copious journals, which Diane went through after she died and incorporated into the book.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Danielle. And let's go to our next caller, Shane in Sarasota. Hi, Shane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes. I started out with a question. I gave it to you. My concern, if you want to put it that way, is not all the many ways we are dealing with this, but our very basis for everything, not simply the matter that you're bringing up.
What are you trying to say?
Everything in the world that is apparently going wrong and has been going wrong for a very long time. What I'm wanting to say every time somebody brings this to me is that we do not have the basis for actually living in the world in a way that we're designed to live in the world. We are patching things up.
You're right. And let's go to another caller. We got a bunch coming in. I see that we're almost running out of time.
We'll go
it's
through
like 10 minutes.
We'll go through a few and then we'll get you to respond.
Yeah, let's get a bunch of people.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for the call, Shane. Let's hear from Dina in Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Dina.
Oh, hi, Dina.
And I was born in the 60s of two people who were born in Eastern Europe during World War II. And that comes into this. But 2 years ago, I unleashed a repressed memory of childhood sexual abuse of my piano teacher. And so I've been going through post-traumatic stress for 2 years. I only distinguished it last November after the second assault in 1 year from someone I was dating. And up until last year, I'd never been assaulted in any dating relationships. And my symptoms got increasingly worse with the first assault and then the second assault. And then I finally realized, thank God, that the media was talking about PTSD and also all the sex abuse stuff, especially with the Penn
Catholic
State
Church
conversation. Uh-huh. And finally I got it. It's like, oh, my God, what I've been calling body grief, because it felt like my body was in grief. Oh, my God, I've got PTSD. So now I've been on a rampage of seeking body work that works with PTSD, because I found that psychotherapy is very limited in what it can provide.
But Dinah, do you have a question for me? We'd really like to know if you have any questions.
Well, you know what? The question is, you know, I'm actually just a supporter right now for normalizing the conversation, because I'm looking at how post-traumatic stress has, you know, been probably a part of my parents' lives and now part of my lives, and it's extremely destructive.
All right. Well, we hear you, and we have to take another call because we want to fit a whole bunch of people in. The phones are crazy, right?
Yeah,
they're just going crazy here.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Dinah, and thank you so much for sharing your story. Let's hear from Richard in Monterey. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What's your question?
Good. My question is, I understand and I empathize for what your father had went through. I have PTSD. I'm a veteran in the United States Marine Corps. And the services that I am given here at the VA, although, you know, in some aspects they're great, and I don't know whether your father utilized that, but in some aspects too, what they wanted to do with me is to just pretty much sedate me. I wasn't in control of my body, okay? I just sat there like a freaking blubbering, drooling idiot. And
wow.
I just didn't know, you know, if your father ever utilized some of those things.
No, but I just want to say to you that is certainly, that seems like a very extreme reaction or treatment for PTSD, as we heard from the therapist who called in and said there are modalities to help people with PTSD that are not about sedating you. I mean, that just seems to be very extreme, and there must be a middle ground somewhere for you to pursue with the Veterans Administration. And I would just continue to pursue that and continue to fight for your rights to get real treatment and not just be medicated, because that just doesn't seem right.
Well,
thanks for the call.
Thank you for calling in, Richard. And so based on your years of doing this research and doing this show, what other advice do you have for people who are dealing with trauma?
I think it is, for me, it has been to find a support system of people who can handle the truth, to quote the military line in the movie. And I found that I lost a lot of friends. People couldn't deal with me at the time. And people, as I say in the show, these stories about people sort of abandoning me along with my parents. And so I developed a whole new circle of support. I found a new partner who has been a rock for me. And I found friends who weren't afraid of me and weren't afraid of it. Usually these are people who had, in the case of my wife and several other friends, people who had undergone their own shock and own loss and tragic sudden death things. And so this helps to have somebody with people around you that have some understanding of this who've also gone through it. So getting that support is huge, and getting rid of people in your life who say, what, aren't you over it yet? And what's the matter with you? And I can't deal with you. Get rid of them and get a bunch of new people and find people who will give you that support and find good therapists. I had a bad therapist in the early part of this recovery, and I got a new therapist. Now I have a different therapist now. And so, you know, get that support system, and then be kind to yourself and understand you're not the same. You're not ever going to be the same. It changed you, and allow yourself to just be really, really kind to yourself and know, I'm not right. I'm not who I was. Mm-hmm. And I think I went through a lot of resistance for years. I didn't want it to change me. I didn't want it to have happened. So I pushed it away, and I kept acting like things were normal when they weren't. And it took me a few years to figure out, I'm different. It's changed me. And I need to learn to accept that.
And speaking of being different and things that have changed you, how have you changed as a result of doing your one-woman show?
My heart broke open, and I think I have more compassion about people's suffering in this regard. I think I have a kinder, more open-hearted approach to my life. I think I'm learning to be kinder to myself. The thing I just preached, I'm practicing. I just have a more tender, open-hearted approach to people who are suffering. And I think before I was much more, come on. You know, I was like everybody else. Oh, come on, aren't you over that? You know, like, you know, let's go have fun. Because I love fun. And that's the other thing is I continue to laugh a lot. I went back into stand-up to help get me in shape for this this acting performance, which is also stand-up and theater. And, I keep my chops up, and that sort of helps channel some of the rage and anxiety that I feel.
One listener wants to know if you've ever thought about having children.
I did back in my 30s and when the biological clock was ticking. But I chose consciously not to have kids because I know what a big baby I am. And I know how selfish and egocentric I am. I mean, I'm an artist. And so I just decided to nurture myself. I also saw, I grew up in a family that wasn't, it was happy in some ways, but a marriage that wasn't. And I've never found anybody I wanted to do that with. And I don't think I'd be a very good parent because I'd be like I was with my cats and dogs. I'd be obsessive. I'd be obsessively controlling. And then I'd be like fed up with them. And then obsessively controlling and then fed up.
Well, we have about a minute left, Marilyn. Final thoughts.
I just would love for people to understand that these traumas that people go through, whether it's from sudden death in a car accident or murder-suicide like me, you can recover. You can get better. You have to find support, but you can recover. And you can find ways to bring lots of humor and joy. Even the dark humor that's in my solo show, you can find ways to go through it, to transform your energy with laughter, with humor, and with love all around you.
Well, I saw the performance on Thursday. Highly recommend. It is so funny. It makes you laugh and it makes you cry. And it does make you tap into some issues that you thought maybe weren't there, for example. It was just amazing to see the audience react to this. Marilyn's one-woman show, It's All the Rage, is running at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco through April 15th on Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Marilyn Pittman is one of San Francisco's first openly gay comics, and she's co-host of Out in the Bay, which airs Thursdays on KALW at 7 o'clock. Marilyn, thank you so much.
Rose, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for all your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What would you change about corporate taxes? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the corporate tax system and President Obama's plan to overhaul it. How much do corporations pay in taxes? From 2008 to 2011, 30 major corporations paid no taxes. So how much should they pay? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What is the economic impact of corporate taxation, and what changes would you like to see? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.